Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hello, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And we're very pleased to welcome back Adam Johnson, who's well known to many in the Django community, and we're going to talk about his new book on Git. Welcome, Adam.
Hello, thank you for inviting me on. And I got to say, snap, Carlton and I are both wearing Django.social t-shirts.
You are.
Represent.
Well, what is that? Tell people what that is.
It's a series of social meetups held globally, I guess now. I think there's going to be one at DjangoCon US, I'm guessing here, I think. But yeah, John Gould, a recruiter here in the UK for Django specific, who's just a great member of the community, giving back a lot, hosting these events, giving back to the DSF. So Django Social is his project for running meetups socially everywhere. And he's also ready to help anyone who wants to jump on and start a meetup in their city for socializing with Django developers.
I've thought about doing one near me, but I don't know if there are any Django developers near me. So if you're a Django developer near me on the Costa Brava, let me know and then we'll do a Django social.
Two-person Django social.
I've been emailing with John because I'm looking forward to seeing him at DjangoCon US. Are you attending, Adam, or you're not, right?
Only remotely this year, yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
We'll get there.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about Git. And since we have you on, Adam, with all your many hats, steering council, maybe this could also be an opportunity to talk about 5.0, because we just, as we're recording, the feature freeze just went into effect, I believe.
And the alpha release went out. 15 hours ago.
So let me defer to the two of you. What are you all excited about that's coming out in 5.0?
Go on, Adam. You're the guest. You go first.
Okay. I've listed three features that I wanted to highlight. The first would be generated field, which Lilyfoot and others pushed through, and Myers got it in at the last minute, this last week. This is a database field that is computed in the database from some calculation across other database fields. So classic example would be you have a user with a first name and a last name, but for some reason you want to be able to search across their full name. You can create a virtual field there that is a combination of those two, and then you can write a query set that queries against people's full names. So like if you've got a type ahead search, you might be able to let someone type any part of their name and it will search across all of it without query set tricks. It's all just done once in the model.
So a way of, removing some of those annotations that you might have sprinkled about various times, you know. But go on, that was one then. What was two?
Okay. The DB default.
Yes.
Which is for defaults computed in the database rather than by Django, which is, I think it was the oldest open ticket when it got merged, like number 470 when new tickets are in the 33,000s. This is big because having your database as a single source of truth for things like timestamps is very useful. It also means Django doesn't need to do anything extra before saving such fields. You can get the database to do the computation if necessary.
Yeah. And like it ties in for me a lot with the constraints works that's gone on. So with constraints, instead of just having, say, validation at the form layer, you're able to make the database have those, and then that feeds back up to the form layer now, which is super cool. But then to have constraints and then database DBs, database defaults as well, that's like, brilliant.
It's just great to see Django like expanding to like cover everything that databases can do and have been able to do for years or decades in some cases, like database defaults.
Yeah. The related one that didn't quite make it, but I'm thinking might for 5.1 is cascades, which is, or, you know, the on delete clauses to have those at the database level. There's a PR open for that, but I think it needs a bit more work to get it over the line.
Yeah. I had a look at it, but that would be cool as well, because it would save like this giant cost that we often pay when deleting in Django, because Django pulls everything in itself before it deletes it. Whereas just letting the database do that work and clean out the disk is a lot faster.
Yeah. Okay. And then your third exciting one?
It's a bit more niche, but it's the dash dash durations flag for the test runner in Python 3.12. Python 3.12 added this, and now Django 5.0 exposes it through its wrapper. That's just a great way of seeing, like, what are your slowest tests. You can say dash dash durations 10, it'll show your 10 slowest tests, and then you know where to work if you're trying to speed up your Django tests.
Which, dear listener, you may not know, Adam has a book on speeding up your Django tests, so you should check that out if you haven't seen that already.
I don't need an update, yeah.
I was actually just looking through that last week because I was stuck on something, and I was like, wait a minute, I have a book on this I've read, and you know, you had some good advice, so it's worth rereading.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
Is there I guess you're working on the Git book that we're going to talk about, have you started work on the update there, or that's sort of later on?
I've done some bits as I go, like when I see something has changed in the Django ecosystem and it's just a few paragraphs to change, I do that, but I haven't pushed those updates yet because I'd like to compile with the latest Sphinx and whatever so the EPUBs and come out in the best way they can. That has been an issue in the past with older versions.
Okay. And that was, yeah.
I can relate, yeah. Yeah, it's hard. Like it's sort of like a chore to put an actual book out. And so there's all these updates that if it were just a website, you could just kind of do.
Yeah.
It's even worse when you have a paperback books. Yes. But you smartly avoid all that. So,
lazily avoid all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well.
Before we move on from 5.9, I just want to throw in one extra feature there, which is the field, the form rendering has grown this new attribute, which is field group. So you know how when you render a form field, it's got like the actual input, like, you know, the text input where you enter your data, but it'll have a label and then it'll have errors and then it'll have help text and all those things. And that's all great, but if you need to customize your form template, having to do all those for each one is a kind of a bit of a pain. So Bound Field now has this as field group helper, which will render that a specific template for groups them all together, which means if you want to customize your form layout, you kind of just do field as field group, and you do the surrounding markup. Maybe you want to use a field set or whatever. It just makes writing those custom forms that much smoother or that much quicker. I'm excited about that. So anyway.
And I'll just shout out, David Smith gave a really great talk at DjangoCon Europe about that transition and what to expect that you can find on the DjangoCon Europe YouTube channel. But I would recommend that if the docs aren't fully sufficient, as they were not for me, but his talk made it very clear.
Yeah, stellar talk.
Okay, so Git.
Is that a cuss word?
Will, come on, easy.
Get it together. Yeah, let's make the puns. Well, so it's hard to know, you know, the level of people listening to this podcast, but Git is a big deal. Maybe what's the quick, why is it worth its own book of performance enhancements?
Sure.
Or just experience enhancements, right? We all use it, but what more can there be beyond, you know, Git status, Git add, Git change?
I mean, that's exactly like the story of where this book came from. I think for a lot of us, like, I mean, Git is not the work, right? The work is like building your website, and it's a thing that's there that's useful, but it's also like in the way of each time you make a change. So I think it naturally becomes something you learn enough to get going, and then everyone like stops. I think that's also a problem from the Git docs perspective. Their docs are incredibly dry, low level, use a lot of terms, they mix up terms because there's like three different names for a commit, and so it's quite hard.
Yeah, I meant to
go,
say
like,
commit. I meant to say commit, not change.
Right. But it is also called a change set, a revision, like various other names in the Git docs is super confusing. So like I found that like there's this kind of genre of hit tweet where a developer shares like, change this one thing in your Git config, and then it gets like 10,000 likes because it's like, oh wow, that just fixes this thing where I had to annoyingly type a command every time. And I just kind of like kept seeing these, and I changed my own config over the last 9 years I've used Git, 10 years. But there's no like central place I found that would explain all these to a new person. Like you can throw them at your Git config, but that's not really a help of like, what does this actually do? So this book is basically my attempt to compile all of that stuff that I've seen into one series of logical short explanations.
Lovely. Yeah. Well, maybe what's one example of something that you now use all the time that like saves you time, improves performance? Like what are some of the, like, what are we doing wrong, right? If we're just using the main, the main big three and like, oh, that's enough.
Like one small thing is autocorrect. So if you've ever typed git commit with one M, it by default just says, I don't know what you're talking about. Maybe you meant commit with two M's, but try again. But the autocorrect feature, you can actually switch it. So it like goes, did you mean commit? And you can just press yes, or you can actually have it go immediately. Like, there's only one thing close enough. It's commit. Let's just do that. So that's like one simple tweak, and that'll actually save you maybe an hour a year, an hour a month. I don't know how well you type.
That's a bit, seat of the pants, isn't it? Automatically correcting your typo. I think, oof.
I haven't had much with it yet.
Well, I like that, you know, we can dive in. One of your chapters is on aliases, because this is something I find that, you know, beginners have no idea about. And if you see someone do a YouTube video or something, everyone has a slightly different alias and they just go the speed of, they just blast through and it's completely incomprehensible for a beginner. So those are very exciting. And like, maybe you could tell us about that chapter because, you know, like for me, like I just do GS for git status, you know, all these little things to your point, they do save you real time, but it's just like, how do you learn about them other than peering over the shoulder of someone doing it or seeing some random video?
Yeah, aliases are a great one because they shorten your typing significantly, which also reduces the chance for typos. There's like two kinds of aliases I cover in the book. There's the shell aliases and the git aliases. So shell aliases are set up in your bash or ZSH config, and they can map to any command. You can basically say, for this, when I type this series of characters, actually do this. And that can be five commands in a chain or just one command with a bunch of arguments or something like that. In the book, I actually recommend pulling in omyzshell's aliases, even if you don't use omyzshell, because they're a curated standard bunch of aliases. And I've helped actually contribute to those in the writing of the book.
Why does that not surprise me, Adam?
A few things as I was writing just kind of annoyed me. But they've got about 300 aliases. You probably only need 20 to 30 of them on a day-to-day basis. But if you spend the time just to learn those, then you could go way faster. You'll be typing like GC instead of git commit, GC exclamation mark for git commit dash dash amend, and so on. The other kind of alias is the git alias. That's something you put in your git config, and that's where you have to type git space and then your alias. That's more useful for wrapping up slightly larger commands with a single word. So I have one in the book that's like git switch recent, which helps you switch to recent branches that you've committed to. It lists them all in order and shows a select.
I've got a git alias to check out a PR, check out the branch for the PR that, like, basically I just couldn't work without it. It's like git PR and then the number of the PR, and it just goes and fetches the branch and whatnot. And without that, you have to do, well, what's the URL? What's the, you know, what's the remote? It's just a lot of faff. Whereas, you know, git PR number, damn. And I literally could.
Yeah, that's nice.
Sounds like a Mastodon tweet, Carlton.
Well, yeah, I don't like hit tweets. Hit tweets. But yeah, so just giving love to aliases.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and it's interesting. I've been mentoring someone recently, and it's been good for me to just re-see. I'm like, well, don't you know about this? Don't you know about that? And, you know, you just forget what we know. And it's like, well, how would they actually learn that, right? There's no, and aliases are one of the ones that a huge time saver that you may not know about. And yeah, as you said, also very accident prone. Like you just, that's the thing that when I first got into coding a while ago now, I thought that coders had like perfect typing skills, and now I realize they're like the worst. It's just they hit tab and have all these linting and tools, and you know, it's almost worse than writers with the grammar.
Yeah.
But now you have Grammarly and stuff, but you know, it's
Grammarly.
Like, you gotta do it perfect.
Yeah,
thanks
for the Grammarly recommendation there. Like, it's really helped this book. I was finding I wasn't putting commas in the right places. And...
Oh my God. Well, they're total Nazis. Like, the commas thing is really, you know, that's the one area where I consistently am like, no. I don't need a comma around every comma, single comma word. But anyways, well, maybe that ties in. So one of our sections is book-driven development. I think you've talked about this before, but what is this concept? How does that manifest for you? Because not how I write my books, but maybe I should.
Well, for me, a book is a bit more of a broad project that I just try and have fun with. And all the things I'm talking about are open source. So it means I can dive in and improve them in some way if I spot something on the way. This is how I've become a Git contributor, through this book, which is a bit of a gauntlet to get a patch actually into Git. It's not done on GitHub. It's done on the mailing list. It goes through your email inbox only.
So Django's not so bad then?
No.
In comparison.
Just on that, how does that email flow with Git work? Because that was the original workflow, right? It was designed to send patches to Linus, basically. And how did that go? I mean, how what's that like?
So the tooling built into Git for this is that it can actually send an email. It has a command to format a patch, and then you attach your text to that, and it sends us an email using the SMTP setup on your laptop, on your computer. I didn't use that. I didn't want to like set up all that. So I used this thing they added a few years ago for making a pull request on GitHub and converting that to an email. So I still had to chase up my comments on email, but at least I got to submit it the kind of normal way to begin with. It's all right. Like, receiving comments over email is pretty much how I'd use GitHub initially anyway. It's a bit all over the place at reading an email that's like got strips of your text, of your patch with comments underneath. It's a little bit harder to go through. You can't just check the box, done that.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Resolve conversation. Yeah. But functionally, it's all similar. GitHub's just a much better UI for doing that than plain text email. That's the other thing, getting an email onto list, it has to be plain text. So you've got to go check a box on Gmail or whatever. And if you don't send it plain text, you don't really get an error message like, oops.
Yeah, because you
it just goes into the
you ether. Want to know. Okay, Karen. Anyway, I just wanted to know because I was, how did that come up? Somebody tooted at me about how this was the one true way. And I was like, okay, I've never done it, but maybe it is.
I think the Git community has often discussed that it's slowing down contribution quite a bit. And this kind of halfway house is where they've managed to get everyone to agree to, because a lot of people who do it are very happy with their command line email client and their command line Git and everything. It's okay. It's functional, and that's all it needs to be. I think it's good for the Git project long term that it isn't tied onto GitHub or any other provider.
Yeah. I mean, that's my sort of one concern, is that GitHub slowly gets more and more dominant and more areas are sort of, well, what is the alternative? What happens if GitHub becomes somewhere we need to leave? Are we able to?
Yeah. And every year they do something that causes another wave of people to decry that this is the final straw, but it hasn't actually been yet. I think it'll be interesting what the future is for Git and Git hosts. I think Git will outlast GitHub by some margin still. And I think whatever comes next in terms of source control will be one of these Git compatible tools that still uses Git as the backend for storing it and just presents a nicer command line interface and whatever. There are a few in the works out there.
Yeah, so that's maybe a fun question to think, you know, put your tinfoil hat on. Like, how does get replaced or something? You know, like what could it do that it can't, or what structurally, are there any obvious things structurally that it, if they're going to redo it now from scratch, you would be changed about its architecture or just how it's used?
I think the big thing with Git is that it tried to be very, very simple with its object database, everything stored in files, and scaling that has turned out to be very hard. I've dived into like recent changes in Git. They're all about like modifying these file-based data structures to scale better. Whereas Fossil, which is a competitor, that's the SQLite source control, that stores everything in SQLite. And so scaling that would be a matter of optimizing a few SQL queries. You don't need to rewrite all the data structures. Maybe optimize some tables, but that's a very well-known kind of space of like, how do we get SQL databases going faster? Whereas Git's doing a lot of low level, okay, now we need to build a special index file for this particular use case. Now we need to build a special thing. And they absolutely never take on a dependency like SQLite either, because they want to work on every platform that only has a C compiler. So,
well, let's, you know, since we have you on to talk about Git, let's talk about, you know, Git reset keep. That's a little tip you have. Like, what can we say about that?
Okay, so do you know what Git reset keep is?
No.
I know what Git reset is. So Git reset will take your working tree and reset it back to how it was before you made some horrible mistakes. But I don't know the keep flag there. So
yeah, well, Git reset kind of does two things. It's the way I would talk about it. One is it can unstage a file. So you've done git add on a file. It's the opposite of that. But the other thing is, if you pass it a flag and a commit ID or name, like a branch name, it will move the current branch to point to that one. And then people typically learn about the --/ soft and the --/ hard options. The soft one, it keeps the changes. So you can like git reset soft to a previous commit, but that will keep the files in the current state. So you're ready to recommit those changes. Perhaps you meant to put them on a different branch. Perhaps you meant to make some tweaks. So you can redo the commit you just did, or the last three commits you just did in one, or something like that. And then hard is for when you want to like throw away changes. It moves the current branch and doesn't keep the changes. The problem
hard is the one where I'm like, oh my God, like I get a little nervous whenever I do, or try not to use it, but sometimes you just get lazy.
Right. Like, I get lazy. It's this thing that you're like, it's going to throw away everything. So git reset keep is like a better version of hard, because what hard does is it not only moves the current branch to point to some other commit, it also throws away everything that you haven't committed yet. It's like a side effect that you don't really want most of the time. So like if you use --/ keep, then like you can have some like test file you've modified and then reset to, like, say you're resetting to origin/ the current branch to undo whatever fixes you've attempted locally to go again. So you can do that and keep the working changes. And I think this is quite important, because the only data that Git doesn't let you recover is stuff that you haven't committed yet. So if you have local changes you haven't committed, keeps them around, whereas hard throws them away.
That's quite handy, because sometimes you try, for instance, made those changes in order to bisect an error, and then you try and check out the bisect and you're like, I've now got to, in between each Git change, you have to take the changes out, like change the repo and then put them back in. That's a pain. Whereas if you could do this.
Exactly.
Well, that's one of the things about Git, and maybe there's a solution to this, is if there's nothing in it, Git won't track it. So if you create a folder for like static files, like images, and you don't have any images yet, and then you try to track it or do anything with it, you have to do this like --keep or just put in a dummy file, right? Like that's something that has tripped me up in the past, and I get questions about that. People, yeah, if it doesn't have anything in it, Git's not going to automatically track it if it's empty.
Right, like Git's data model only tracks files, and that kind of makes sense if you think about it, because you wouldn't want it to like keep around empty folders that have had all their files deleted. You wouldn't want to have to worry about folder permissions as well as file permissions, things like that. So I did write a blog post about this. I guess that's why you're asking a question. No?
To be honest, I don't recall the blog post. I just have a thing in my book on this, and it causes problems for people. And so that's why I added one of the updates, like .keep or blank files, because...
This is what
Which is to say, it's a common thing. Oh, yesterday? Okay.
I thought that's why you're asking.
No, that would have been... That would have been smart of me.
Yeah. There is this practice of adding a blank file called .gitkeep or something, but that still requires you to...
Oh, my God. Yeah. I swear to God, I didn't see this.
It requires you to still add like a gitignore rule for everything else in that folder. But you can actually do this by just dropping a gitignore file in the folder you want to keep around. And writing a couple rules. The first rule is star, meaning ignore everything in this folder. And the second rule is exclamation mark dot git ignore to say, but don't ignore this dot git ignore file.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I was thinking of an older dot keep, not git keep. But actually, something you promoted, which I was like, oh, yeah, that's important, is the work that Brett Cannon just did on Python 3.12, right? We're going to have automatic... git ignores for the virtual environment, I believe.
Oh yeah, that's a good feature. Very happy to see that got accepted and merged. Python's virtual environments, if you use the virtual env package, which was the original way to create a virtual environment, that added at some point this feature that drops a .git ignore file with just the rule star, meaning ignore everything in this directory, into each virtual environment. So you can't commit those virtual environments and push them to GitHub, which is a classic beginner way of duplicating code. And now that's been added for Python 3.13 in the VEMV module, the built-in version of virtual env. So that will save a lot of Git environment virtual environments getting committed. And it'll also mean we can all remove a rule from our Git ignore files from that point on.
I know. I hate just copying. I don't like to copy over the Python one from GitHub because it's so long. But there's always like 10 different things every new project I need to just put in by default. Mm-hmm. Like, and maybe Django could do that.
Cool, that's controversial.
Is there any debate on that?
It's not a debate you want to have, because if it comes, like, someone will mention it, and then it's just like not a conversation that ever goes well. So it's just best not to mention it.
Okay. Well, you two would know. I haven't.
What happens with sort of esoteric conversations with Django is because there's so many users with such diverse requirements that what works for the sort of 50% case, it's going to upset an awful lot of people. And it's like, and so these kind of little changes, which look little, and that doesn't matter, we'll just do that. But actually, a lot of people get upset about it. And it's like, no, okay, we just won't do that. So Django's default git ignore is quite minimal, or I don't think it even has one in the default template, but even in the repo, we don't put every possible git ignore in there. So you might use PyCharm, and I might use VS Code, and you might use some other one, and so we don't put like the git ignores in the Django repo for every different IDE. We say, look, use the local git exclude option. Now, Adams, you've got a different take on the git exclude. I saw a post you did a few weeks ago on...
You can create a global ignore file for all of the repos you work on. So if you're using PyCharm, ignore PyCharm across every repo you ever work on, and then don't bother adding stuff to every repo you work on. That's in the book, but it's also a blog post.
With the blogging, because you blog quite a lot, right? And that's why I thought you were going to do a book on Python typing, because you just, a whole series of blog posts on typing. I'm like, oh, Adam's going to do a book on this. And you didn't at the time, whatever reasons. But like, you've blogged quite a lot to first draft it, or to think through your ideas, clarify your ideas, just for fun?
I guess it's because I think I'm quite forgetful.
Right, okay.
You just want to Google yourself. You're like, what is this thing? And then you phrase it exactly as the title of your blog post, because that's how you think, right? I find that, right? Even if it's a topic with lots of stuff, like I always, future me phrases it like past me. And then I'm like, oh.
And I guess it's also a way of like gaining confidence in what I'm doing. Like if I'm about to make some project-wide change on a client project, I'm always like, I should write up exactly what I think I'm about to do. And then by the end of it, I've got a blog post because I've like found all the potential flaws and gone like, okay, here's how you use this tool in Django. Here's the problems that I found doing it.
So it's like a way of tricking yourself into writing a spec.
I wanted to ask you, because like Carlton, and maybe even more, actually more than Carlton, maybe you have so many third-party packages that you both maintain and new ones that you work on. Like, I mean, let me just pick one. I think that you took over Core's headers. Like, you can't really do most APIs without this. Like, what, I don't know, talk to me about like what, how do you manage all that? How do you, how big a burden is it for you to manage things like that that are just core pieces of the infrastructure of Django? And then I know you have some newer ones as well.
I guess I just like collecting them. And one issue that always frustrated me coming into the Django ecosystem and working with it for a few years was that these packages were sitting there. They had a lot of stars. They had a lot of downloads. But the maintainer wasn't around anymore. The pull requests were piling up. The uncertainty it added to, like, am I going to be safe upgrading to the next version of Django with this package? Oh, it seems to throw a warning. Maybe it has a problem. How will we ever fix this? I just decided to like carve out my own little niche of like the packages I own. I'm always going to try and keep them up to date for Python and Django. And maybe I'm not like super active on adding features or making them like more modern in some way or another, but I want to keep them working. That's like my baseline. And to reach that goal, I've like normalized them all to like a single uniform template, and then I can script editing them. So with the Django 5.0 alpha, I decided to test them all. It took me about 60 minutes of work this morning to actually add that to the 16 packages that I have.
Yeah, I just looked through and it said you updated them all like this morning. I was like, yeah. And you've mentioned before, like I think maybe at a conference, how you did that, because otherwise you just couldn't. Like it's just such
right.
It's too much.
And every other project, the maintainers have picked some slightly different tooling. They've gone for poetry rather than setup tools. They've gone for testing with Travis, or still using Travis when Travis has stopped working. Or they're all in this kind of like landscape of different tooling that is very hard to navigate. And I do go and make, you know, new Django version pull requests to packages that my client projects depend on, but it's a lot more work figuring out where all the pieces are. Like, where do I write Django 5.0? Where do I write the update on the docs? So, yeah, keeping them uniform is like my secret weapon there.
My experience is very similar. I took Django Filter Y because I was using it. It was basically unmaintained. I needed to know it was going to work. Same with Crispy Forms. I was using it in projects. It was basically unmaintained. It was going to break. And, you know, somebody had to take that on. So I took that, you know, and so on. You know, that was how I did it. I look at you and what you do with the number of projects you maintain. I'm like, yes, that's the way. So slowly, you know, it's not something I'm going to do on the weekend, but slowly, okay, can I systematize slightly more so that those small differences between the packages slowly go away? And then what's this tool? All Repos is the tool you use, right? Is it?
I use one called My Repos. There is All Repos.
Okay.
I wouldn't necessarily recommend My Repos. It's
right. Okay.
Just a way of running shell commands in each of many directories.
But like you've used this, the basic idea is, yeah, that you can run the same commands on multiple repos. And that's, you know, that's an awesome thing. So I need to get to there. I'm not there yet, but you know, mostly it's like, okay, we're going to use Tox, we're going to use GitHub Actions, we're going to declare the Tox file this way, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, I was just working on a new project and I was like, God, everything is so slow and buggy. And it's because I hadn't added Browser Reload, one of the packages you have. And there's just so many, I mean, you wrote a book on improving your Django developer experience, but, you know, when you just don't have all the tools that we have and set up, it's just like, you know, it's like one hand behind your back. Don't having pre-commit, like, I mean, it's just hard because there's your book, right? It's just like a a bunch of setup that takes time and like, why am I doing this? And same with, you know, optimizing your Git, right? But once you do, you just don't realize how much faster you can go.
Right.
With these tools.
Yeah. Like the defaults are good, but if you're spending hours a week doing this, then it's always worth committing some small percentage to improving how fast you go in the actual work hours.
Amen. So, I'm going. Well, I just wanted to ask you in the notes about the Git book. You've got this. You mentioned Pigments Git. Now, that's for highlighting, right? So, tell us about that, because that tweaks my sort of. What's that?
Pigments is the popular Python-based code formatter. I think GitHub used it even until they made a Ruby version of the same thing. Pigments is like got a lot of highlighting rules. It can highlight Python code, shell code, like 100 other languages built in, but there's nothing for like Git related files. And so I was finding that my Git blog posts and my book were very dreary. It's all black and white, even when the editor
they're already about
show you that.
Git.
Yeah. It's already about Git. So I wrote something that tries to restore some of the color that you would see when using Git or using Git syntax highlighters in your editor for things like the commit message file. So it makes the book a little bit more realistic and hopefully a little bit easier on the eyeballs.
What editor or IDE do you like these days? I forget. I'm not sure
I've
if I've asked you that.
Sublime Text since 2012 and no plans on changing.
There you go.
For me, the big selling point is it's got Python that you can extend it with. So I've written a few small extensions that do what I want. And sometimes if I've got some large refactoring, I'll write an extension that does a few different editor commands for me. So it's not quite the same as like just regex replacing everything in your code. You're stepping through still. Maybe you have to type something at each step, but that's a cool middle ground, I think.
Pre-commit. I think I wrote a blog post on this because I was fiddling around with it for a reason. You've written a bunch on this, I think, and there's some stuff on Git and pre-commit. Like, what would be your little soundbite on that? Like, what maybe for people listening, what is pre-commit and why is it, you know, worth a mention in your book?
Pre-commit is an awesome tool for running all your code quality tools. I've actually written a chapter on it in both the Django DX book and now the Git DX book, which is much less Python Django specific. The cool thing about it is that it's not just a way of running tools. It is also a kind of package manager. So you can throw in a tool that uses the Rust or Go or JavaScript or Python toolchains, and the user does not need to have those installed. It knows how to bootstrap entirely each of these programming languages, package managers, and then the tools from scratch. So very easy to throw in one extra tool that is maybe not something that, you know, not using a language anyone in your team is using, but it just works. And yeah, it's stability and flexibility. The sheer number of tools, yeah, it all adds up to like a pretty good developer experience.
Do you, you mentioned Rust, do you like Ruff or are you still on the Flake 8 bandwagon? I know you have some new Flake 8 packages you've been working on. But
I think Ruff is a cool tool. I use Flake 8 still. I've never had the need for like extra speed. I think the unification aspect is very interesting and probably will help a lot of projects, especially if you're getting to a larger scale, just keeping everything managed. We'll see where it goes because I'm more of a fan of like open source community managed than open source company managed.
Yeah, there's that.
Yeah, so for those listening, Ruff is written in Rust and pulls in Flake 8. And yeah, that's the big selling point is that it's much faster than Flake 8 and tools like that.
Can I ask you about inertia? I'll put my hand up. I'm, you know, front of the line for I'm quite slow to change my tooling choices. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll be second last off the boat quite happily every time. And that's fine. How do you... Because I'm just not interested in taking on the churn. It, you know, if you get into every new tool, you're changing tools three times a year, and the time saving is never worth it for me. That's kind of my reaction there. How do you handle that kind of tool change yourself? How do you, you know, any balance between the considerations of, oh, I'm spending a lot of time looking at tools, and, oh, this is actually a better, this is a step forward.
Yeah, I think I'd be conservative like you with like swapping, but I'm also very happy to go add new tools. I guess part of what I do is helping companies add tools. So I've added Flake to several projects this year, so I might as well. Like, if I'm going to go through it, I'm going to research new plugins or whatever that could help out people.
If you're selling apples, it's helpful to have fresh apples.
Exactly.
So is that, I know you do consulting work. Is there a typical type of project you get brought into? Is it like everything's on fire? Is it like everything's slow? Like, is there kind of a bread and butter, or is it, you know, hey, we need someone who really knows this stuff?
I guess more of the latter. I've helped a few companies this year, like just improve their DX tooling in some way. So that might be setting up pre-commit and all the tools for the first time, or it might be like updating things and writing a Flake 8 plugin for logging after I was auditing the logging setup for my client Silver.
And so can I ask from a sales perspective, are you able to have any kind of metrics where you can say, look, you know, I had this kind of improvement in productivity, or, you know, this company said, you know, are you able to gather that kind of data so that you can present that in a sales call?
It depends on the problem. One client this year asked me to improve their startup time because I'd written a blog post on how to improve a project startup time, the time it takes to import everything before Django actually does run server or shows you the shell or whatever. So I could show very obvious improvements there, like doing this thing saved a second, doing this thing saved 5 seconds. If you do this thing, you know, that's the classic consultant move. If you do this thing,
you don't want to do it yourself. I've just had the manicure. No, fair enough. Good.
Well, I think though, I mean, even just for anyone to have someone who's trusted just come in and take a peek, because that is one of the things about code is that often you're no one outside of your team is seeing anything. So, right? Like, I mean, if we all looked at each other's code, well, maybe I wouldn't help as much, but you two would definitely like add a lot of insight, but it's not often done unless it's like a new team member or you have that external gaze and there's just stuff littered right? I mean, there's just not always hard stuff that is just unawares because you're busy doing the thing that you're doing.
Yep.
I just always wonder if there's any way to improve that, or, I mean, even something as simple as like, I'm in Boston, there's all these doctors, like surgeons, you know, you get trained in surgery for forever and then you're just solo for until you retire. And a handful have like brought in like retired surgeons to just like watch them operate. And like, you know, everyone needs a coach basically in any field. And it's, you know, in coding, you definitely don't have that. I don't know, a vague thing I've thought about, like, is there a way to do that? I guess the answer is you hire a knowledgeable consultant periodically to come in and be like, hey, like, this is what's changed. And also, here's these obvious things you're doing that could be improved.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a model where there's like a list of things to go through. If I like look back through all the things I fixed in all the projects, there's a bunch that didn't quite make it into blog posts or a bit nebulous, but definitely something to check when reading code.
Maybe that's your retainer. You should have an AI of yourself, Adam. Adam Code Pilot, and just
maybe.
But I think as well, like the DX tooling that you put in place, and things like pre-commit and whatnot. Especially if you've got in a team environment where you can't expect a junior developer to come on and be able to master all these tools. Whereas if they're already set up to run automatically, and that's got to have visible gains for a company that implements that.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, we have a little bit of time. What else can we talk about, Adam? What are you working on? Carlton, you have?
Well, no, I want to ask. So I've got Adam in the room. I want to ask, come on. So Django 5.0 is just out the door. What's on, you know, your steering council member? What's on your roadmap now? What are your exciting things that you want to look for us to do over the next, you know, 5.x series, say? Or if we could wave a magic wand and change one thing, what would that be?
That makes it easier.
Same thing. You're on the record here, boy.
There's this package that Gordon Rickley, my previous boss, made. That's called Django Auto Prefetch. And that changes the prefetch behavior from prefetch. Well, when you access a field that wasn't fetched in your query, like a foreign key, Django by default fetches a single one. It changes that to fetch that field for all of the instances that were in that query set. It's a clear performance win for nearly every situation. Nearly all the times that you fetch a query set, you're going to do something with everything in that query set. And last year I had a discussion about a way that we could get this in with Simon Charette. And
I was about to ask, have you checked Simon about this?
Just didn't manage to take a look at it. It's a big one because the idea is not just to like add this one behavior, but to add at least one other, which would be, you know, anytime you access an unfetched field, like just error, which is necessary in the async case because you can't do a database query on attribute access. But it's also something that several packages have created in third-party cases. Django Seal, Django Zen Queries, they're both
added. Yeah, those are the two I wanted to top of my tongue. I just wanted to... Yeah,
both added so something behavior. So in core, it would be nice to have it that you could tell the ORM, actually, do this. And maybe it would be a context manager or just an option that gets changed.
We do some sort of Kickstarter to get like you and Simon and Marius locked away in a lodge somewhere and, you know,
speaking of that, I've had a couple of people email me about like new projects and, you know, Kickstarters, because that's happened in the past. And when I was on the board, I was always like, no, the board can do it. Like, let's, like, we can raise the money. And I have to say, I've gone full circle to like, you know what, like the DSF has enough to do. And, the you know, if people want it, maybe a Kickstarter or something like that isn't the worst way to do it, because it's just to have it within the meat grinder of Django machinery is probably too much. It'd probably get in the way of things. But at one point I thought, oh, well, the DSF can raise money more easily than a Kickstarter or something could. And yes, but then you have all the friction of a community, I guess, as opposed to just doing a great new feature.
What about the issue you've discussed before about DSF being a foundation, not paying for coding? I think you've softened on that since that you heard the PSF pays for coding, right?
Well, I'm not on the board anymore, but yeah, I mean, they have lawyers. They looked into it. They said it's fine. So, you know, if there were any problem, we could just point whomever at PSF and they could deal with it. I don't think it's a restraint. I think that was often used as a reason why not to. And at least I'm pretty sure the current board certainly knows that the PSF is doing it. So.
Well, when I started as a fellow, it was explicit. It was like, no, we've had legal advice such that you are a community manager. You can volunteer, contribute to Django as a volunteer, but you're not, your fellow role is not that. Now that, you know, since that discussion with Python has evolved.
Well, we in the board talked to Eva, who's running PSF, and, you know, I've looked at the history of where that legal advice came from, and I would trust the PSF, you know, both in terms of who they asked, and perhaps the landscape has shifted, but PSF has lawyers who focus on tech stuff who said, it's fine.
Okay.
I think that advice was a very conservative take by someone at the time who wasn't actually in the tech space. And then it was treated as gospel. You know, we want to be conservative.
Well, you don't pay a lawyer for advice and then disregard the advice, right? Like, that's pretty fine. Oh, no. We didn't like that answer. Let's just go with this one that we made up.
But this was literally like someone who was, you know, emailing me saying like, why doesn't Django do da da da? And I was like, well, you know, you could do something. And yeah, I think Kickstarters or something like that. Like, I mean, the question is, do we need to vote in any way? Like, just send around like, hey, here's like five ideas, or, you know, but the problem really is, you know, how do we get the time of Adam and some people?
Yes, Carlton. Well, no, carry on. I was putting my finger up, not to interrupt.
We need both. I mean, the money to me is easier than the community agreement and the people who can actually do it, finding the time to do it.
The other thing that's been mentioned is sort of called, you know, community sprint, like Django sprints, like, you know, to get together and have an event, a bit like a Django con, but without without the conference bit and just do the sprints bit for three days or so? And could we arrange that? And there's keenness. I've seen, it's not just Paolo, that I've seen other, you know, people who are involved who've sort of said, oh, is there an idea for this? Oh yeah, I might, you know. So if we could organize that and get in a space together, that would be an amazing
I mean, the sprints are amazing what they do in a handful of hours, right? Like, and yeah, they don't have to be attached to the conference.
So anyone at a big company listening to this who wants to sponsor a Django development sprint,
yeah, this new feature brought to you by Microsoft. Yeah. Well, I think, unfortunately, we're coming up on time. Adam, we're going to have links to everything. Is there anything else you want? Currently, you can pre-order the book, right, and get a discount. Is that right? Is there an official?
It's not a pre-order. It's an early access. You get 80% of the book, and then you open up some pages, and they say to do. I've written up to 90% now. I covered the two big bits that were left, which are Git Blame and Git Bisect. As more advanced commands, I taught them from scratch rather than just being like, you know, Git Blame, right? Well, why don't you just turn on this thing?
Yeah, good, yeah.
So
good.
It will be done.
There's no reason not to go get the book now.
No, there's no reason. You'll save $10 and it'll be out probably in a couple weeks, 4 weeks. I don't know. I'm not going to commit to any timeline with a young baby in the house, but it's coming together.
Well, thank you so much, Adam. It's always a pleasure. We'll have links to everything. People should check out his work if you're not already using it. And DjangoChat.com, right? That's our usual.
Yep. See you
going
next,
out.
See you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks very much for having me, Cotton.
Thanks for coming on.